for being here and welcome. Did everybody get a chance to receive the March meeting notes? And is there a motion to approve our meeting notes for March?
So moved.
Second. So there were, we do not have any comments from the public, so I would assume we don't have any comments from the public. Well, unless there's public somewhere, but okay. Moving on. So we have a very exciting meeting tonight with some of the Board of Health and the county counselors that are here tonight. So thank you guys for spending your time with us. We appreciate it. And I think we'll go around the table and introduce ourselves in a little bit. And Alan's going to briefly discuss part of the meeting, just kind of what the mission of the Public Health Advisory Council and kind of our background a little bit. And then we've got a couple just short presentations that some of the council members are going to do to just explain and highlight some of the work that we have done over the last few years. And so we have some packet handouts on that. And you know, the hope tonight is that this meeting is not confrontational, but conversational. Excuse me. And that we can have kind of an open dialogue, and we can get some information from you guys and your roles, and have any questions that you have for us that we can answer to. So I'll start, and I am Adrienne Fairbanks, and I represent a doctor of veterinary medicine practicing in Clark County. I'm a small animal practitioner in Salmon Creek and at Mountain View Veterinary Hospital. And I joined the council to advise on any animal health issues that may arise and also promote public health in the human-animal bond and the sector there.
Are we doing this
today? Sure.
Now we are.
Now we are. I am Roxanne Wolf. I'm the Director of Community Health and Safety with the Clark County Public Health Department. And I've been here almost 5 years now. And I was really excited. I came from Central California where I worked with, I worked in the private industry, but I worked very closely with some public health departments up and down the Central Valley of California. And one of the reasons why I went back late in my career to get a degree in public health was because of how much the public health colleagues really impressed me and the work that they did. I really felt during that time that I found my vocation in having the opportunity to work with public health. So I'm really honored to be here, and I love this. We have a great department. We have a great group of people to work with, and I very much appreciate FAC and your willingness to volunteer an evening every month to help us work on public health issues.
Great. My name is Marla Sanger, and I got to know the Public Health Advisory Council probably about 3 years ago when I was a director for community health with Peace Health. And then when I retired a little over a year ago, I didn't want to give up this great opportunity. And luckily for me, there was an opening for a consumer of public health services. So I applied for that opening, and I was able to remain on the council, but in a different capacity. What really has attracted me to this kind of work is it really took me back to when I was a very young a nurse. I had started out working in infant ICU, so very highly technical. And from there, I went to a place called Angoon, Alaska, and did public health nursing in a village of about 450 Tlingit people on Admiralty Island in Southeast Alaska. So that was a very wonderful education. I fell in love with the people, and it really struck my interest in public health. So come full circle, and I get to participate in that again.
And I'm Lydia Gurman. I am with Clark County Public Health and the Administrative Assistant.
I'm Marissa Armstrong. I am communications specialist in Clark County Public Health. Now I feel pressure because Roxanne had these things to say about why she's here. I've been with public health for almost a year now after spending about a decade writing about health departments and health issues as a reporter for newspapers and most recently the Columbian.
My name is Sandy Brown, and I represent the Consumer for Public Health Services. And I used to work for WSU Extension for about 38 years doing food safety and nutrition work and working with families in the community around being healthy. And when I retired, I didn't really want to give that up. And I realized it takes a village to have a community to be healthy. And so I was interested in this committee because it hits a variety of things around the health of a community and not just the areas I focused on for so long with WSU in the area of nutrition and food safety. So when I retired, I applied to come here to represent the consumers and broaden my knowledge and also use some of my expertise in the nutrition and food safety area.
Some of you may know me, it's too bad. My name is Bob Richardson, I'm the police chief at Battleground. Right here I represent the Law Enforcement Council, which happens to be the sheriff and all the police chiefs in the county.
And I am Ernie Eason, I represent the dental community here in Clark County. And the reason that I joined is, I guess there was no other previous dentist on this board. I wanted to see what dentistry could actually add and provide to the board.
Hello, my name is Mark Collier, and I represent subject designers, installers, and opportunity maintenance people. And I have a private subject consulting firm. My background is public health, environmental health. I've worked for this health department for a number of years, and then went private. And my interest in the board is the partnership that the subject industry has with the health department. It's just really got the rules reinforced on us. We've worked very closely, and I think this, you know, this council is a way to help continue that relationship.
My name is John Roth. I work for Clark Public Utilities and represent Clark County Water Utilities. My interest in the council was working in public water. It contributes greatly to public water. We contribute a lot to that, and I wanted to gain a little perspective as well as be able to share a little bit of perspective, so that was really a lot of my interest.
My name is Paul Childers, and I represent the restaurants of Clark County, along with Mark and Joan here, with one of the founding members for the Public Health Advisory Council, and of course, restaurants. And it has to be synonymous with health, healthy restaurants. So that's why I joined them, and I've been here for quite some time now. Enjoy it.
Healthy food and healthy restaurants.
That's right.
Hi, I'm Joan Bailey, and I am a community health nurse, but I actually sit on this council as an elected representative in the city of Vancouver. And of course, my interest in being on the council from its inception was my passion for improving health aligned with my education experience as a community health nurse specialist. So.
Hey, I'm Charbonne O'Gord, I'm the principal of Battleground High School. We have this educational community rep. Brand new is the one we're saying here, so I've been a resident in Clark County for about 20 years now. I've worked with a lot of community members. This is a really great opportunity.
I'm Dave Fuller, I'm the director of PRESA, representing both the 911 side and emergency management, obviously, as well as overlap between our agencies and public health.
Good evening, I'm David Scott, I'm the city manager at the city of West Hugo. I started on the advisory council when a city manager from the city to be unnamed called me and said it was my turn. But I'm grateful to be part of this. Obviously, public health is an important mutual concern for our constituents that live inside cities. And I represent, I'm a non-elected representative, so long here, non-elected representative of Clark County cities and towns. Got Art Vancouver, where I work but I like Vancouver because I used to kind of worked in Vancouver for 11 years before coming to West Hugo.
I'm Arlene Dirty, and I represent the medical doctors in Clark County. So I moved to Vancouver about 2.5 years ago from Seattle to start the mental health department at the Vancouver Clinic. So I'm one of the psychiatrists there, and really have always been interested in public health, but never really had an opportunity to kind of delve into it before. So particularly interested in how mental health and public health and the, you know, the intersection of that.
Hi, I'm Cassandra Selichrek. I'm from the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. Welcome to our land. I'm your tribal delegate in life. I grew up in Milwaukee, Oregon, which is just south of here, and we moved here in 2001. I am a trauma nurse from Legacy Emmanuel Hospital and a primary ECMO specialist in the neurotrauma ICU. And then in my tribal life, I'm their health board chair, the Cowlitz Indian Tribal Health Board chair, and their youth board chair, and several other things. And I think public health is one of the most important things that we can have. In tribal life, we think everything is public health because we're just one big community, and that really isn't any different here. We're a big community, and so the health of the community is vitally important, just as every individual member. So we appreciate the opportunity to be able to partner and be able to be at the table with everyone, and we have some unique tribal needs and desires, but really look for the health and well-being of the entire community. So thank you. This is my sister, Darlene. We travel together. It's a very traditional thing. So I'll be sharing culture by having people sometimes with me.
My name is Darlene Rhodes. I'm a health board committee member, and I just happen to be along for the ride today. Good to meet you.
Jeff Arbison, I'm the Administrative Services Director for Public Health. I oversee everything in budget finance related for the department, and I've been here not quite 21 years.
John Blum, Clark County Council, and I'm somewhat ashamed to admit that I had no idea there was a Board of Health before being elected to County Council. One of the things I've really enjoyed getting to learn over the last 2 years is, appreciated the work that public health does, and kind of unseen heroes of Clark County in a lot of ways, doing a lot of good things behind the scenes, that until someone, you know, has a restaurant especially that doesn't go well, has a reading experience that doesn't go well, recognize the importance of public health. So appreciate everything that all of you do and your volunteer work. And your professional work in all the different groups as well.
Yes, it's a
nice,
robust committee. I'm Eileen Clarkman, and I'm the council chair, and also serve on the Clark County Board of Health. I hate to admit it, but I certainly didn't know that when I came to the council that we were actually the county board of health. So, and of course, public health is of optimum importance, both for food safety. That's one of the things that I think the public often thinks of right away. But then when it comes to outbreaks and that sort of thing, of course, public health comes into play. So thank you for being here and the opportunity to visit with you.
I'm Lindsay Schaefer. I'm the senior policy analyst to the Clark County Council. I think the only thing I would add is staffing the Board of Health. I am constantly reminded of how thankful I am that there are all of you that are out there looking after the public health and diseases and things so that I don't have to. Somebody is monitoring them. I'm very grateful for that.
Alan Mullen, I'm the public health director and health officer, and I believe I've been here for 13 years. I think almost the last six is the combined public health director and health officer, and it's really a great community to work with and work in, and I really appreciate the support we get both from the Public Health Advisory Council and the Board of Health, and from our community partners in general. This is the best public health place I've ever worked.
Julie Olson, Clark County Council and Board of Health, and actually the Board of Health is one of my favorite things that we do, because I have a degree in microbiology and spent my career in scientific sales. mostly in the food safety and science area, but cast along a lot of different areas in science. So it's one of the favorite things that I do that we do, so it's fun for me. And again, I just want to say thanks to the work that you do, both in your volunteer work here and your work in the communities. And the foundational public health issue is critically important, not just to Clark County, but the state of Washington and nationally. So your work is recognized and valued, so thank you.
Sean Hennessy, Clark County Manager, also known as the guy that showed up late to the meeting and missed dinner. I was going to give the introduction, and I'm going to go.
Not temperature used for too long.
Lots of mayonnaise over there. But I know I see a few other victims, I mean participants in the other meeting that we just came from. Yeah. So that's the reason why I was late. I really wanted to see what we came out of that as in regards to the CFAC committee. So I actually did discover, since I've been county manager for 8 months ago, that the council did serve as the Board of Public Health. It is different. Some of the other counties I've been in, for example, Jackson County, there was a total of 3 health department employees employed by the county for a county of 750,000 people. So obviously it was not a major focus. However, at least in Wisconsin, the county where I was county administrator, there was more of the joint structure that we have here in terms of what Dr. Belton currently oversees. So became much more familiar with that. So still on a learning curve, not a purely vertical learning curve like it was at first, but hey, it's 8 months in, so I know I'll still be learning a lot. And I do at every single meeting, and I hope to not have to see Dr. Melnick in regards to very many more of these emergency declarations.
My name is Stephanie Rosamasha, and I am a nurse practicing in Clark County. I am a psychiatric and mental health nurse with Peace Health, and was interested, like Dr. Underdy mentioned, about the crossroads that mental health and public health play in having a community that allows for, you know, wellness and healthy activities. So I'm happy to participate in this council.
I'm Katie Wen, I'm a Clark County Youth Representative. I'm currently going to Gila High School, and so we opened a new pathway for public health, and this is just an opportunity for me to learn more about it.
And I'm Janice Cutch. I support the Grants for the Environmental Public Health Program.
All right, I apologize. Alan was supposed to go over his thing before the introduction, but okay, it'll be okay.
I can go over. Should I go over it now?
Yeah, and yeah, I just, you know, I do think you can just. We have such a diverse professional group of volunteers, and you know, we always say it, but you know, thank everybody for being on this board and spending time to donate your time and your professional skills. It's very appreciated.
So I know I can not be concise, I'll be as concise as possible. So public health around the country is a state function, and every state does it differently, and every state organizes it differently. And in Washington is a home rule state, so we have local jurisdictions and local boards of health, and they can come in different flavors. Actually, it's up to the Board of County Commissioners, in this case, the council, in each county as to how they want to organize it. And in Washington state, we have county health departments like ours. We have some city, county health departments like CKing and Tacoma Pierce, sorry. And we also have some health districts, which are multi-county districts. And actually, Clark County used to be part of a multi-county health district that was Skamania, it was Southwest Washington Health District, and it included Skamania and Klickitat. So it's Clark, Skamania, and Klickitat. And sometime before, around just before 2003, I think Klickitat commissioners decided to form their own health department, and then Skamania followed, and we became a county health department, which we've been ever since. What happened, though, was when we were a district, and the way districts and also city-county health departments are formatted, they have much bigger boards, and their boards include representatives from the community. And so there's a lot of input into public health policy from these large boards. So what the Board of Commissioners back in 2003 did was create a Public Health Advisory Council to be able to get broad input from both consumers and the industry and other political entities, as well as other professions that interact with public health, be able to get that kind of input into the Board of Health. So the role of FAC, or the Public Health Advisory Council, is to provide that kind of advice to our Board of Health, which is our county council, and provide that kind of advice that wasn't, you know, was no longer available once we were no longer a district. So I don't know how concise that was, but that's the history of how we got to where we are now.
Is there any questions? I mean, it sounds like you guys are all aware of, you know, your role as the Board of Health, and that we're here to help in any way that you would like us to help. So we're going to go, Janice, going to start with the logic model and kind of go through that.
So in your packets, there is a logic model. This was created in 2011. We've actually looked at it with the idea of perhaps updating it, but it really seems to still resonate with the council. So what we decided to look at was really the advisory council at the time was, what is it we're trying to achieve as a council? We know that we're here to advise our Board of Health, but why are we doing that? And this is what we came up with. So long-term outcomes, what this council really wants to do is improve the health of Clark County, achieve health equity, and eliminate health disparities, and expand influence of public health and public policy. So that was really, for them, why they're doing this. The short-term outcomes, I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but there's also some short-term outcomes that they wanted to achieve, and part of that is where they're advising the Board of Health on what's happening in the community, what's happening in the sectors that they represent, and how do they get some of that information to our board about representing our community. And then how we do that is they wanted to influence public policy. That's where you can really make some major changes in your communities through that public policy. They wanted to have an opportunity or a format where they could advocate for improving the health of the community and also guide and support Clark County Public Health. So there are many times where we go to our advisory councils to talk to them about our strategic plan or what our vision is, but also getting input from the council about what direction as a community member do you feel like public health should be going. And they've also been supporters of ours when we've had budget shortfalls, so giving us some ideas and directions about where they see the critical areas for public health and how they would advocate for that. And then at the top, this was all based on really what they value, which is the strong relationships in the community, a diverse opinion and background, consensus building to meet the needs of the community, transparency of public and private efforts, and social justice. And those are all the things that this council values. And the whole reason they do all this is so that they can provide appropriate, timely, and adequate input into the Board of Health and your work that you're doing.
Also in your packet, there's a timeline that looks something like this. And this gives you an idea of some of the work that FAC has done since its inception in 2003. The lines represent actual sort of the time, the amount of time that we've worked on these specific initiatives and kind of where they fell on the calendar. The stars represent action items, things that actually happened during that time. And so there's a variety of different things that the council has been working on while they've been in operation. And a few of these things we're going to talk about, we're going to highlight tonight in a few minutes. We are in the process of updating this. I just need a larger piece of paper. It's going to be a giant piece of paper by the time we're done. But there's a lot of things that we've done, a lot of initiatives that have been very, very, that are not only community driven, but they were also you know, initiatives that helped us to build on the work that we had previously done. So there's a variety of things in here. First of all, if you look at the top left-hand side of the page, protecting groundwater was one of the things that early on was something that the community brought that we've been working on. And so not only did we work with FAC, but we worked with other community partners with regard to this particular topic, and we brought out some policy recommendations and things like that around that. The other thing was the meth town hall that we had, the meth tax. That was something that was a big issue between 2005 and 2008. There's several other things that we've been focusing on as well. And most recently, and I believe Paul will be talking about that a little bit more tonight, was an ordinance that we passed around vaping and aligning that with the smoking in public places law. So we'll be talking a little bit more about these, but this is just a graphic representation of a lot of the work that you've done. It's very impressive, and it continues. And it really is a testament to the expertise that we have on the council and the work that they do to bring the community voice here.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
So on the Food Systems Council initiated, mm-hmm. what was the conversation and background to develop and kind of create the Food Systems Council? I think we get sometimes some different feedback on what that organization is about and what their mm-hmm. purpose and goals are. And I'm just wondering what was the impetus to that
particular
group.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, do you have some background
on that? Yeah.
Okay.
Sal?
Sandy?
Or Joan?
I can talk.
Absolutely.
Sorry, who's starting? Council. Yes, the Food System Council. Basically, it works along with FAC, and that we're basically doing the same. It's almost interesting how we're almost coordinate the same facts and procedures between the two groups, and yet we're operating separate basis.
There are some things that you all worked on when you came together, like the healthy restaurant. Do you want to,
yes.
Joan, do you want to add anything?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah, some of it was, some of the things that were going on. I mean, early on, you know, Paul had talked about, from the Restaurant Association, trying to have a restaurant, have a more healthy options. We even talked about a logo, et cetera, that became, the focus became really on the quality of on healthy food. And so it was at that point that we decided there were a lot of people interested in helping pursue that. Also, it was related to community agriculture, really looking at supporting our local farms and making sure that we advocate for continuing to have those local farms, local produce. And it was also there was a time in the past that when we had the our wonderful friend Ridge, we had one of the trunnions had to be replaced at one point in time. There was a lot of discussion then about where we get our food in Clark County. A lot of it relies on that bridge. And so there was also that discussion about where do we get our food locally? What could we do to become more sustainable as a community? And so there was a lot of activity around food that then we suggested and went forward to create a group of people to really look at the issues of healthy food, access to food. Those were some of the things that pushed toward the development.
And we have also at this point in time we've got a group together working on healthy kids menus with healthy options. That's where my main direction is, because it's through teaching kids how to eat healthy that we promote that for future generations, and that's the thing. So we're working on that right now.
Yeah, so the Food System Council Camp was an outcropping of the Healthy Choices, Community Choices grant that we had, the county had a number of years ago. And through their work in trying to make healthy food choices available, and there was some forums in the community, out of that they said they wanted to have some kind of a food policy committee. And it was determined at that point that we really didn't want to call it a policy, because the group didn't want to be in charge of making policy decisions or policy choices, but it's a food system council that educates the community about local access to food and having that local access and encouraging agriculture and jobs in agriculture and having more local food access. So the Food System Council was created in order to help educate the community around policies that might affect local access and how people can take initiative in that. And they've sponsored two food summits now in conjunction with the Clark College and is working on a variety of other things. I happen to sit on the Food System Council and their activities. So it's been going since about 2010, but it was came out of that Community Choices grant and from public interest in having a food system council that would help educate the community around local food access and promoting local agriculture, small businesses around creating local foods and things like that. So one of the projects that they're currently working on now is supporting creation of a food hub where agriculture, local ag producers can help distribute. So.
I remember back, we were looking at food deserts and you guys were also looking at neighborhood groceries,
right.
Stuff, small grocery stores and being able to get produce and stuff like that.
Right, and we've partnered with public health through that whole endeavor because I think we have some joint kinds of things that we can help support, but we try to take an educational role in trying to be bring more awareness to the community so they can affect policy or affect what goes on in the community, and that's why we didn't call it a food policy council, because we didn't want to be the one driving the policy.
Food deserts are still a major problem right now in Vancouver and Clark County. How to get around that is still something that needs to really be worked on.
And another issue I recall that Food Systems Council was working on, and it came here, was, and I can't recall what the actual disposition was, but for some of the local farms out in the rural part of the county, if they set up a vegetable stand and cars would stop, it would create traffic. And so there was an attempt or, you know, a plan to sort of say that wasn't allowed, but then that really created problems then for the local farmers to not be able to make their produce available locally. So I know there was some kind of resolution that I just can't recall.
So this is just another example of the work that not only starts here, but also moves into the community. And the Food System Council continues to be a great partner of public health. We sit, you know, we support that group, we sit with the group. The information, a lot of information comes out of Food System Council, which really helps us with the work that we do too. So it's a really, really great partnership. So one of the things we're going to do tonight, there's a few things that we wanted to highlight from this, and we had some of our FAT members were voluntold. No, they volunteered actually to provide some information back about in a little bit more detail about some of this work. We're going to talk tonight about the Growing Healthier Report, the Health Element, which is one of the major projects that came out of FAT and the task force that we started. We're also going to be talking a little bit about the adverse childhood experiences. We'll also be highlighting the vaping bill. And then we're going to be talking about the focus going forward, what we've been working on. So Joan, I think you were going to be talking a little bit about healthy. Okay.
You know, in 16 plus years I've been on this council, one of the big projects that we undertook was the development of the Growing Healthier Report. And part of that, the work that we did on that was really going, it was a two-year project, and we were actually charged by the Board of Health and by the Council to actually develop this report. It came about because of the discussion that we had with the Board of County Commissioners at that time about what is it that the commissioners wanted to help them do their work, especially as we began to think about the Comprehensive Growth Plan. So in 2010, we began identifying recommendations for the Board of Health to consider when looking at the growth in our community and how could we grow healthier? How could we, because we're going to continue to grow, so how could we provide some recommendations about a health perspective on that growth? And so what we did is we worked for 2 years and we looked at what are called social determinants of health. And we did a chapter on each one of them, housing, access to healthy food, open spaces, economic development, social connections, the environment and the climate. And so there were eight of those elements, but just to walk through some of them briefly, one of the big ones, which we're seeing a lot of action on right now, is affordable, safe housing and neighborhood plans that incorporate green spaces, access to transit, access to healthy food, and then again in our partnership with the Commission on Aging, the idea of universal design, so that we could create neighborhoods instead of siloing people, we could create what, you know, used to be the norm, where people would age in place, that, and there would be older people, younger people, single people, all living in the same community. And so mixed income, mixed use, and mixed family structure. So that was the chapter on housing, quality, safe housing. And every recommendation that we developed was based on the evidence. We had what we call staff work with very diligently finding out what's the current evidence, and then we looked at what were the current conditions in Clark County, and then what were the recommendations that we made. Second one was access to healthy and affordable food. And this included just the discussion we had just a few minutes ago about what the work of the Food Systems Council about access to healthy food, and you know, the issues of, you know, you'll look at that old report and you'll see where the food deserts were, and then the preservation of agricultural lands. And these were things that the council, commission council, addressed as they went through the comprehensive growth plan planning. And then we promoted the access to opportunities for safe physical activity. Bikes, bike lanes, complete streets, safe pedestrian zones. And what I do with my students when I talk about healthy community growth, I use an example, and I'm gonna use my hands, and I'm just gonna share this with you because it makes sense. Students, at least. So over here in this part of the county, we have a school, and it's a combo school, middle school, primary school. We have a big piece of open land right here, and over here we have a big development, and over here we have another, you know, library, dry cleaner, grocery store. And when this development was built, there was no connectivity, and so the families that live in this community, this is a busy arterial down here, and the families that live in this community don't want to have their kids riding their bikes on this busy arterial over to school. So what do the families do in this community? They get in the car, and so there's a lot of traffic, there's a lot of pollution to the air from the cars, because there's no connectivity, so that they can have a walking school bus or ride their bikes between. So when a new development comes in, one of our ideas that's in the report is building that connectivity. So this developer comes in and builds this new housing development, and there are trails that can go from this development, through this development, easily over to the school. And then also, this developer gets the idea and creates it where you can go to the store. So instead of popping into your car to drive to the store if you need something for the big dinner, what you do is you send one of your kids on their bike over to the store. And it's healthier. And you can have walking school buses to school. And so those were some of the recommendations about trails and parks. It would be nice for families to go for a walk, you know, and not be so automobile centered. And then we talked about what could we do to promote safety in our neighborhoods and community connections. We know that one of the big problems in our country right now is social isolation. And so again, if you think about communities that are built with that provide services to all kinds of people, you know, with different income, that would be beneficial to all. And then we looked at, you know, a health indicator is, you know, we know that, for example, the reason people are healthy is not because they have access to medical care, it's because it's based on wealth, education, and employment. 80% of what makes us healthy is those things, not whether we have a primary care provider or access to a doctor. And so, and a lot of that is driven then by economic opportunities. And so we talked about, you know, what it costs to live in Clark County, and what could we do to get more living wage jobs for families to live in our community. And then we talked about a safe physical environment, and one of the more controversial chapters at that time was what we called climate change and human health.
really looking at what's going on in terms of in-migration of people to the Northwest and the changes in the temperature, you know, more hot days, more people being exposed to excessive heat in our part of the country, and again, planning for that. Cooling off, cooling stations, and that we have to begin to think about as we design our communities. And so this whole report, which took well over 2 years of regular, consistent work, we took our recommendations and we went through, I think John, you were on the Planning Commission at that time, and so we went through some hearings.
We were talking about the food stands, but that
came
out.
Right. And so the Board of County Councilors adopted those recommendations for the Comprehensive Growth Plan in 2012, and then some of them were actually integrated. But, you know, certainly there's still, you know, we wanted to be a start that as we began to think about our growth as a community, we would think about what are the things that could be made, the decisions, the policy decisions about growth that could be made by our county council that would improve the health of our community. So we've talked on our back about what's the status now of that Growing Healthy report. Do we need to go back and revisit it? And this is where we'd like some feedback from you about, is it something that you would find useful? Would you like us to go back and look at those, update them? You know, so it's a lot of work, and there's still a lot of good work in there, but is it, we didn't want this report to just be on the shelf. We wanted it to be something that would be useful, you know, in our role as a fact to advise the Board of Health. So,
is the Commission on Aging doing
helping? They're doing their reports related to aging. You know, they've done their first report on supportive services and transportation, and they did housing was their first report.
Right, and then transportation residents. And now, I believe it is this.
They're doing Healthy Community. Health. Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. But they're looking at it from a little bit different standpoint than we did. Yes.
When was the last report completed?
In 2012. It was right before you went. We went through all the comprehensive growth, you know, the hearings and the land and the boundaries. And those 7 years go by really fast. Is it 7 or 10 years?
Every 7 years. But it takes 3 years to do it, and you know, 3 years.
So anyway, so one of the things that we've talked about at our past meetings is this something that you would find useful for us to relook at, or is it something that's still solid enough work and evidence-based? There's been some new evidence that's come out of this whole area that might be relevant. But again, we don't want to, we know it was an important piece of work, but we'd like some advice from you about where you'd like us to go with this.
Would it just be an update? It wouldn't be starting over.
It'd be just
it would be an update of the current difference.
Yeah. Oh, no, we wouldn't start over.
I would say maybe a highlighting of what are the tangible, hard policy things. So, for example, as we're talking about 179 in the council and other things like trails, we have the ability to go through and do these developers agreements so that they are beholden to require trail connectivity as part of the developers agreement. So that's a very tangible, that's a way that we can actually take these good recommendations and see them put into practice on the ground. So any recommendations like that, this reviewing, you know, okay, what's the thing that we can say, this is where you can really focus to make this a reality, I think from my perspective would be. So I don't know if that gets to your question of do you redo it or do you just go and do a highlight of it here, you know?
I think the whole really issue of connectivity, not only physical connectivity, but social connectivity are things that this plan would have less to do with social connectivity other than if we have parks and places where people can congregate. But physical connectivity in terms of trails and, you know, bike trails and complete streets, you know, where we can make it easy. You know, if you just think about, we talk a lot about walking school buses. You know, instead of having kids riding cars, you know, you have to have good walking space to get people from one place to the other, especially kids, you know. So
the timing, if you were to just kind of maybe consider, you know, validating your data, what's changed, what hasn't changed in the last, you know, 7 years,
our next comp plan is going to be due 2024, so we're going to start on that in the next couple of years. So if there was an update to this prior to that, that might be good timing. I mean, I would imagine the council could, since we're not all here, you know, are there particular areas of interest in this that, that we see going forward? Maybe we have a separate conversation and get feedback to
We know that right now there's a lot of discussion about housing going on. There's activity in county. I don't think we would need to do much on housing because right. there's so much going on in our community about housing.
Is this the time to make comment about this report for an area that isn't covered? Or is it to give advice to the people who are looking at it?
This report was approved and submitted back in 2012. And so if we decide, if there's action, if we decide to take some action on it based on some feedback from the Board of Health, for example, there's nothing in here about kids, you know, about ACEs and kids in terms of, does that have anything to do with, it does in terms of meeting places and places where kids can play safely, not in here, so. But yes, I think that would be very, if we choose to do that, that would be very important.
Well, I think this report misses opportunity to address cultural sensitivity or any sort of community culture in here. From a tribal perspective, there's nothing that addresses policy or procedure or the county with what they do if they find artifacts that are found in the area that are native specific. And so that would be a concern that would be brought up. Many of the buildings or some of the lands that are bought and sold in the community have very traditional places, and so I don't really see that addressed. There's probably a list of other things that I can think of that might be important or part of this that could contribute to goals, especially with the natural environment thesis.
So another one of the things that we have worked on for our timeline is adverse childhood experiences. And that's something, that's a concept that I know that all of you have probably heard about, but we've been doing some deep dives and we're working with a lot of our community partners around that too. The schools are very involved in that as well. And Bob Richardson is gonna talk a little bit about some of that work that's gone on in Battleground as well as some history around that versus work that BAP has done.
So, smiling because Joan's talking about the health element and the comprehensive plan. 2012, that's when I came into this council. The only reason I came into it like Dave is Jerry Lucas didn't want to do it anymore. And I was a junior police chief and said, it's your turn. So I just remember coming in my first meeting talking about all this high level stuff, and I'm sitting here as a policeman. A cop, what does this even got to do with me, right? But over time, it's you realize that it's all interconnected, and that's why we're all here. So ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, that came out of a study that was done by Kaiser Permanente back in 1995 and 1997 down in San Diego, and they actually surveyed 17,000 patients trying to look at commonality with doctors about what was going on in their lives. And they found out that people that had adverse childhood experiences, they could be, you know, victims of child abuse, sexual abuse. They could grow up in a home with a lot of domestic violence, single parent, poverty, you name the issue. And the study showed that people that were in this kind of environment tended to have more health issues into the adulthood, but also they've done a lot of studies now that say that not only do they have more health issues, they actually have more contact in the criminal justice system. So back about 2012, 2014, we started talking about ACEs and what we could do outreach in the community. So we decided to actually do some training. And the people we focused on were people that had the most interaction with children, and that was law enforcement, mental health providers, medical providers, and schools. So they've come out, they did a lot of training out in battleground. We did it with the school system. We did it with the law enforcement. We actually had in-service training where we came in and we talked about diverse childhood experiences. And we all actually took a little survey, and you count up all the experiences you had in your life, and you realize, you know, how did you ever make it to where we are today? Or how did I ever become a cop, right? So with that being said, we also did trauma-informed care, and also we did a lot of training on adolescent brain development. The fact that, hey, what happens, you know, a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old, our criminal justice system treats them completely different. 17-year-old, hey, you're a child, we'll give you all these breaks, and this magic birthday comes along, and you turn 18 years old, and then we just say, hey, we're gonna start hammering you and throw you in the system. So that allowed us to sit back and say, okay, are we adding to this problem in law enforcement? And we actually looked around and we go, yeah, we are. You know, we take a student at one of, you know, a high school. I'll pick on Battleground High School because my friend had it at the table. But, you know, most of the kids we have issues with in our high school, with our school resource officer, they're minor assaults, they're minor thefts, they're possession of tobacco, alcohol, and marijuana. And we would take these kids, we would throw them in a police car, handcuff them, drive them to the station, do our paperwork, throw them in the back of a car again, and we would drive them to juvenile hall. And juvenile hall would sit there and decide 90% of the time, hey, they're not going to stay overnight, so we're going to release them back to their parents. So we've disrupted the kid's life. We've added trauma to this child or young person. We've taken them out of their healthy environment. We've taken them out of school, so they miss class. And so we've done everything we can wrong to fix the problem. And so what we did is we decided, hey, let's change our policies and procedures. Let's go back to nuts and bolts. So we now have a process written in our policies that, hey, when we have interaction with a juvenile or a young adult, where we can, let's release them as quick as we can back to the parent. We don't have to handcuff everybody. We don't have to transport everybody. Not everybody has to go to juvenile hall. A lot of times we can release them back to the school, we can release them to a parent, and we can take a report. And so we started doing that. And then that dovetailed into a new program we have called school-based diversion. So we work with the schools, and our schools do a fabulous job. Now they have prevention intervention specialists. They have people to talk about substance abuse, anger management. We have mental health, clinical hours for mental health treatment in our schools now. And we decided, hey, with these kids that we have, why don't we divert them out of the system? So we started doing that just, I believe, a year ago, January, where a school resource officer, we arrest a kid for a minor crime or a possession or something like that. We take the report and we give it to our school resource officer. He calls the student and the parent and they say, hey, you know what? If you go into a prevention, some kind of prevention program in the school, we'll hold this report back, and all we care about is you complete whatever the school says. We don't want to know anything about your what's going on in your personal life. You talk to counselors and work all that out. Can you mental health? Do you work all that out? At the end of the day, we give something back says they've completed the process, and we take that report and we close it out, and it doesn't go anywhere. And we do that with a lot of the minor crimes. We don't do it obviously with something very serious like threat to public safety, but for the most part, we do that. So that keeps the kid, the child in his own environment. He's got, you know, parents, school, and he's not out of his own support system. So that's how we do it in Battleground. And we've also done countywide training with our school resource officers. We did a little bit last year in adolescent brain development. We're going to do some more this year in June with all the school resource officers in the county. And we get together and we do countywide training to get everybody, all the schools and all the SROs on the same page. So that's basically in a nutshell what we've been doing.
How similar is what you've been in Battleground to the other law enforcement jurisdictions in the county?
I think that, you know, I always like to say that, hey, Battleground's first, but you know. I think what happened is we were just lucky. Being here on the council allowed me to get some resources into Battleground quicker. But I can tell you that over the last, since 2014, that it's more common to have everybody at the table, including all the law enforcement agencies. Again, when we do our school SRO training, everybody's at the table. I know that the Sheriff's Department's done trauma-informed organization training, and I think that what's unique, even in our community, you'll go to a restaurant, and I'll talk to sit at a table with somebody or go over here, people talking about diverse childhood experiences and how they had them in their life, and teachers and medical professionals. It's kind of common terminology now that you never used to do. So I think it's relatively common in our county. And I also know that the police academies now are teaching ACEs and they're teaching adolescent and brain development, because we all know that, you know, especially young cops, because I did it, you tell a kid to do something and they do exactly the opposite, and you go, oh, you're being disrespectful to me. And so you end up arresting them for something. Well, you realize it's a process the way that we do. So.
Can I just add what Bobby said from the time this council supported the work on ACEs, and the, you know, public health has supported the ACEs Action Alliance, and we have over 400 people that are on our email distribution list, and we still hold meetings every other month, educational meetings, and so the ACEs Action Alliance is still a very vibrant coalition that he's at a point right now where thinking how to more formally organize some of this huge number of people that are interested in advocacy and different areas to go on that. So Bob's been a real, police have been a, law enforcement has been a part of this from the outset.
You know, I'd also add that I've been fortunate to work with three different law enforcement agencies in education. So I work with Vancouver PD, County Sheriff's Office, and now Tyler. Student mental health, especially in Ballard, just in recent years, has really been the primary focus, because we've just lost too many kids. But one of the things that started to shift when I left the classroom in 2007 and went into administration and started working with cops and firefighters as well as strange ones. But what I started to notice was that the same in education, our focus is shifting away from punitive measures for behaviors to restorative measures for behaviors, which largely came from the county. From the juvenile justice system in Clark County. Because what we realized is, and research bears this out very clearly, with what we've done my whole life and for decades prior to correct student behavior just makes them quit, and then they drop out of school or they reoffend, and then, you know, if punitive measures work, we would have the best penal system in the world, and may not. So we're trying to err on the side of education, and it's really a paradigm shift for a lot of adults because they want their pound of flesh. And so we sort of counter with, well, does it work? Because if it doesn't correct the behavior, why are we doing it? And so it is a slow shift, though, to get people to really buy in. Our law enforcement agencies have been huge, very, very helpful in that.
I know that with the Youth Commission, we've been learning about youth mental health, and ACEs has come up for our policy report this year, so it's very interesting to apply that knowledge in this board.
So Julie, I know that I put you on the spot. I think you need to leave to go to another meeting. We very much appreciate you being here. Did you have any other questions though before you left? And we're going to go on and talk about some more things, so we'll have some of that in our notes. But did you have any?
You know, I don't have questions in particular, and then I just want to reiterate how grateful we are as a Board of Health for the work that you do, and certainly Dr. Mullick brings to us based on the work that you do here and in the community. And I just appreciate what you're doing. Again, Board of Health is my favorite.
Thank you, Councillor. So the next thing we were going to talk about on our timeline is the vaping ordinance. This was also something that was more recent, but a lot of work that the FAC did on the vaping ordinance. And it has been a major concern in the schools as well. As vaping became more popular, the school was having a lot of challenges. Kids were able to vape in school with something that looked like a pen, and there was no telling what they were vaping. It could be, nothing. It could be marijuana. It could be tobacco. So it was a major issue for our community. And FAC really did a great job with coming to the fore and putting together some ideas around what eventually ended up being a successful ordinance. So Paul, you're going to be talking a little bit about vaping.
Right. Basically, this is something that, of course, as I just mentioned, was directed more towards the kids and how to control this. So we brought it up at our FAC meeting. And in 2013, FAC advocated for a vaping ordinance that prevented sales of vaping devices and materials to minors and prevented vaping in public places, aligning with the smoking in indoor public places law. The ordinance was passed in June of 2015. Also in 2015, we recommended to the Board of Counselors that they support the state legislation to provide to protect minors from accessing e-cigarettes and other vaping devices. The board supported the state legislation known as the Washington Vapor Products Law, which was ultimately passed and became effective in June of 2016. The law imposed restrictions on packaging, flavoring, shipping, and advertising, displaying of vaping products, as well as penalties for minor possession and for retailer sales to minors. The law allowed Clark County and other jurisdictions to impose or continue to impose restrictions on use of vaping products in indoor public places, places of employment, and in outdoor public areas where minors might be, like schools, playgrounds, and parks. In addition, Clark County also requires no vaping signs in public establishments like restaurants. Clark County also allows vaping in stores that only sell vaping products, and only selling vaping products which have independent ventilation to prevent vapors from escaping to surrounding public areas. As a result of this legislation, the Public Health Department has worked closely with businesses to make sure the law is understood and provide support for business owners who need to comply with the requirements. Additionally, FACT recommended the board's support of the recently passed Tobacco 21 legislation, which raised the legal age to 21 to purchase tobacco vaping products regardless of whether or not they contain nicotine. The Board of Health provided support to this bill, and ultimately Washington was the ninth state in the nation to enact such a law. FACT will continue to support efforts to reduce youth access to vaping products in our community. Just coming over here a little while ago, I heard on OPB that Walgreens it was going to require anyone to purchase tobacco products to be over 21. And I think that they're going to be doing this nationwide. This is kind of interesting because each state has a different age. And I think for simplification, they would require that anyone to be over 21 to access tobacco products. Didn't say anything about vaping, did say about cigarettes. So, yeah.
Thank you. So these are some of the things that we've done, and now we're looking into 2019. So Marla and I are going to be describing a bit of a process that we've gone through over the last year to identify some other things that were that the FACT is interested in considering. There are a lot of large, big, broad topics. We've talked about some of those tonight already, but there's some that are bubbling up. And I think Charbonneau, you mentioned that earlier with some of the mental health issues going on in your community. That's across the board. So some of the things that FACT identified that they wanted to really look at is school health and safety, gun safety and injury prevention, and violence prevention. Those are the large, broad topics that they came up with last year, but those are very, very broad. So we went through a series of exercises to actually narrow those down so that we can figure out what it is that we would like to focus on, to pull data in. We have a list of criteria as well. Like for instance, you know, with these broad topics, does this topic area really align with FACT's advisory role to the Board of Health? That's one of the criteria that we were looking at. Ability to provide some recommendations for policy change. Is this an urgent topic locally, nationally, regionally? So that's another criteria that we looked at. There's several other things that we looked at when we were considering these topics. And several of our meetings last year were dedicated to completing exercises to help us narrow in the topics. So Marla's going to talk a little bit about some of the outcomes of those discussions.
So the exercises that we did were very dynamic. Some of them were the whole large group, and some of them were small groups where we could kind of delve into more detail. But they were very well organized and relevant, and I felt like we got, they were very good experience for being able to uncover some new ideas and aha moments and things like that. So for example, during our discussions, one of the things that we realized was that some of the things that we were very interested in were topic areas where it's not easy or maybe even possible right now to extract the data that we would need in order to come up with salient recommendations for the Board of Health. So that would be something that would have to be overcome in order for us to pursue those topic areas. We also recognize that ACEs, which we've just heard about, and trauma-informed policies really underscore everything else. There really aren't any other topics for which these things, the ACEs and the trauma-informed care, have a part to play. And so that's something that we are kind of considering across the board when we look at specific, focused, discrete topic areas. We also realized that there was a need for FAC members to become better educated about what's already going on in the community. What are our community partners doing in these areas already? Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's not have duplication and waste resources, but to collaborate with our community partners and learn from them and those expert in those areas so that we can create better focused recommendations for the members of the Board of Health. And finally, looking at things overall, I think one of the biggest discoveries was that the collaboration is probably the most important piece, that we really do need to work with the community and not be in isolation, but again, leverage the other activity that's going on in the areas that we care about and come up with some things that will be implementable to provide background for our recommendations to the Board of Health.
So based on the criteria that came up, we had these series of exercises, and then our last meeting of the year in 2018, November 2018, we really narrowed down the topic areas that we're going to be focused on in 2019 and beyond. Focused on exploring how to support efforts to improve gun safety and reduce suicides in our community really rose to the surface. So those are two things that kind of go hand in hand. Suicide rates continue to be a concern not only at the local level but nationally as well. And certainly, you know, we've recently instituted a child death review, and one of the areas that we're looking at is youth suicide. The data also shows that easy or ready access to firearms often plays a factor in suicides. So we really want to look at how can we be safer with the guns that we own in our homes? How do we be safer about gun ownership? So those two elements, like I said, kind of go hand in hand. So we've had the opportunity so far to hear from several community partners, including ESD 112, who talked about their Kaiser model for risk mitigation in schools. So they came in and they presented to us last year. We're bringing in other partners to discuss their efforts around gun safety and suicide prevention, including Commission on Aging. Council for Homeless will be here, I believe, next month. The Prevent coalitions around the county and around the region, mental health and substance use treatment providers and others. So we have a whole laundry list of folks that are going to come in and really address that educational element that Marla was talking about before. We also are going to be collaborating with other organizations such as the Department of Health, the ACEs Action Alliance, which I think Jim mentioned earlier, and other health jurisdictions to identify some evidence-based practices that they're putting into place as well. So this year is going to be a really dynamic year. We expect that we'll be bringing information back to Board of Health based on some of these things that we're doing, and we're very, very excited about it. Yeah. So in a nutshell, that's kind of where we are for the year. I think we wanted to just open it up for any additional discussion at this point. I don't know if you all have any questions or if anyone else on FAC has any questions, thoughts?
If we ask questions along the way.
Okay. Okay. So I think the next section. Do you want to do this part?
Sure. Okay. So I think were we going to do a legislative update? Yeah.
We're going to have a session.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah.
I'll do this in a few minutes, so because I think the only new thing really is the vaccination bill. So the Foundational Public Health Services bill passed, but it doesn't include funding yet. So unless you've heard something newer than I've heard,
we should know
in about a week. So the governor budget included $22 million ongoing biennium. And so did the House, and the Senate recommended 12. And I'm not sure where it's going to be decided in a week. I think there's also, there's another bill, the vape tax.
Right, so there's a question in terms of whether or not, basically how you fund it. So one chamber is predicating their foundational public health funding on a tax on vaping, and the other chamber is not. And so if you don't have the tax, where do you come up with the money, or do you impose the tax, I think is what they're addressing.
So we would mean our original ask was for $296 million, and then it got down to 100, and the governor put. So if there's two sources, that would be okay too. But so that's where that's at. Tobacco 21 was passed and signed by the governor, so that was a milestone. Actually, there are two of Harris's bills. That was one of Harris's bill. And so was the vaccination. So the vaccination bill went through some, so there were two bills originally. One was a Senate bill, and I can't remember the number, but that included a list of vaccines to remove the personal exemption from school. So it got to be a list of, first it was everything, then it got to be a list. And at one point, daycares and preschools were excluded. Anyway, that bill died. And then the Paul Harris's bill, 1638, I think I'm going to remember 1638 forever. That bill got through the House, but then amendments got added to it. And then we were able to get those amendments were amendments that actually made the bill almost an anti-vaccination bill. And we could talk about that if you want to hear the details. Those bills, those amendments ended up being removed from the bill, and actually the Senate just this past week passed the bill, which is basically the what we call the clean bill. It's actually the Harris bill, the original Harris bill. So that is, the Senate passed it, now it's on the way to the House for concurrence. And we should know, when will we know, Lindsay, do you know?
We will know, if the legislature adjourns on time, we will know by Sunday. If they don't, it will depend on what the governor and the legislature decide in terms of what the scope of the special session is. If it's just a budgetary measure, I would suspect that this probably wouldn't be considered a budgetary measure, but I've been surprised in the past in terms of what they consider to have a fiscal impact. So
if this passes, it would remove the personal and philosophic exemption for the MMR, not for other vaccines, but measles has always been one of my scariest scenarios anyway. So having the MMR, even though it's limited to the MMR, I think it's a great first step, and it looks like it's going to go through. So if anybody has any questions about that.
I remember at the last meeting you had mentioned that the exemptions, so there are, you talked about the exemptions, those are no longer in this.
You mean the additional language?
The additional language.
Yeah, there was some language that actually, what made me really concerned was it took some, it removed the personal exemptions, but it created a couple of medical exemptions, said that a provider could write a medical exemption based on family history of a sibling or first degree relative, which made no sense, as well as parental preference, which is basically turning a personal exemption into a medical exemption. So those were stricken from
the amendments. So it's pretty clean in that,
it's
but
clean.
Just MMR, and are there a lot of, are most states, is this a typical, which states have this?
Well, there's only about 18 states, 17 or 18 states that have personal philosophic exemptions.
So we will still be one of those states, except we won't have it for MMR. And I don't know what's happening on the other side of the river.
Yeah, I'm going to ask that too.
Hearing tomorrow.
Huh?
You're hearing tomorrow in town.
Do you know anything about, I mean, I don't, it doesn't.
Yeah, I got this stuff.
I don't follow it. So, yeah, so it basically removes the personal philosophical exemption here for MMR.
For daycares and?
Yes, daycares, preschool, it's all included. Kind of excited about that, so we'll see what happens. I just want to, it's not on the agenda, I just want to give, since we're nearing the end of measles, and there's a couple of discrepancies, so, you know, when we decide to clear the measles outbreak over, so we always had planned to use two incubation periods. So incubation period is the time when you get exposed to the time when you develop symptoms, and that ranges from 7 to 21 days. We're going to use 42 days from the last case when we would declare the outbreak over. We, Clark County Public Health, decided that we would use 42 days from the last day that the last case was contagious, which would be 4 days after rash onset. 4 days after rash onset of the last case was March 17th. So April, we decided that if we don't have a case since then, April 28th would be the day, that's this Sunday, I believe, that we would declare the outbreak over. You may have heard, well, we've had some discussions, State Department of Health, we decided to use a more conservative measure. State Department of Health and the CDC were thinking that they would count it two incubation periods from the first day, from the rash onset of the last case. So they were thinking of declaring the outbreak over the 25th this week. So we're splitting hairs here. I would tend to go with a more conservative approach. We convinced our Department of Health partners to go along with it. So the plan is, and I just got an email from Secretary of Health wondering what our plans were. The plan is that if we don't have any more cases by this weekend, we will have a press release ready to go Monday morning announcing that the outbreak is over. So that's the plan. You have anything to add? Marissa and I will be working on that press release. I don't want to do like mission accomplished.
We stopped talking about it. I thought we were going to jinx it.
The thing that worries me is, we go ahead and do this and then we have another case. Yeah. I mean, it's as long as the vaccination rates remain low, too low, and as long as we continue to have travel, not only from outside the country, but within the country, we've got a couple of outbreaks going on elsewhere in the U.S., it's inevitable that we'll see measles again. The nice thing about it is getting time of year that, you see less measles in the summer. So I'm hopeful and optimistic. Were you going to say something?
Dr. Melnick, I was really shocked when I read that Oregonian this weekend and they had the article on patient zero.
The patient, not our patients.
No, but
we don't have a patient zero, and I can explain to you why.
No, and that's what you're saying, but then I was reading that in the paper that there's just that continual pursuit of.
Well, there was. I think it was a traveler from Israel. Yeah, and you might also be hearing there was a flight attendant. There's a lot of misinformation going on, not around vaccine, not only about vaccine, but around measles and how benign it is. And there was a flight attendant who I think at one point was in a coma, I don't know if they still are, but measles encephalitis. So we haven't seen any deaths, unfortunately, any encephalitis here, but the rate of that with measles is 1 to 3 per thousand. And we've had 73 cases. And by the way, our case count I'm going to let you know here, it's going to go down to 71 from 73. And the reason it's going down to 71 is that two of our cases moved to Georgia, and Georgia wants to count them as cases. So even though we really have, you can't double count. So we will explain that all also. So, because people always question us about, you know, about accuracy or something like that. By the way, about the patient zero, you might have read that our first case was a child who traveled from the Ukraine. That was the first case we know about, but when we do the investigations and we investigate each case, we ask, in this case, we'd be asking the parents where the child was for the previous 27 to 21 days, as well as where they were during the period when they were contagious. Plus, we want to know, you know, who got exposed and how it was transmitted. Based on the answers to those questions, we cannot epidemiologically confirm that the first case we knew about was a case that led to all the other cases, if you're following me. So we can't call that patient zero based on our investigation. Just the first case we knew about doesn't mean that there are any other cases out there. So we just want to be as accurate as we can. Sometimes everybody wants a definitive answer to something, but we have to go with where the data are. And for me, the relevance is you got a disease that still exists and you've got an unvaccinated population. That's what we need to be dealing with. So anyway, that's where we are on measles, and we should hopefully have an announcement on Sunday.
Monday. Are you saying there could have been more than 71 or 73 cases in the county? There were some that just never
That's the nature of the beast with communicable disease, yeah. Because for every case, and it's not just measles. Mm-hmm. It could be other things as well that, you know, to be diagnosed, you have to, you know, get sick enough. Mm-hmm. You have to go to a doctor. You have to get the test done, you know, get diagnosed. And I'm sure there are people out there. And that's why we have to be careful about how we work with the public also, because we want people to come forward when they get, you know, well, we don't want them to walk into an emergency room with measles, but we want to know about cases. So we want, you know, really being able to control a communicable disease is based on the amount of trust we have with people as well. So, but the bottom line is for virtually every communicable disease out there, there will be cases that you don't know about that are out there.
I thought interesting, I read today that there's a case of mumps in a small community in the north of Tri-Cities. Have you heard anything on that?
I've heard about it, yeah. But I haven't really looked into it. You know, I'm not a big fan of mumps. I mean, the thing about mumps, I think about mumps, there's a couple of things about mumps. One is a vaccine for the mumps vaccine, which is part of the MMR. It's not quite as effective for mumps as it is for measles. That's what, you know, measles component is the most, you know, is a really highly effective vaccine. Not that it isn't the best thing you should do. People should be vaccinated for mumps. Mumps is not, in a prepubescent person, you know, who is not at risk of orchitis, which is inflammation of the testicles, or oophoritis of the ovaries, it's not as serious as disease as it is, and, you know, as measles is. So I get a little bit more, I'm not downplaying mumps. I wouldn't be happy to have a mumps outbreak, but I get a lot more scared about measles than I do about mumps because of the morbidity and mortality from it. You know, chicken pox is nothing to sneeze at either.
So yeah, I guess that's my question too, just to, MMR is three different things that it's vaccinating for. It's not just measles.
Measles, mumps, and rubella.
Right, and so.
Yeah, and actually, now that I'm waxing poetically about it, rubella, which is also called German measles, can cause, you know, birth defects. And I think, you know, one of the questions we got, I think we might have gotten it at a Board of Health meeting, was about Japan. And, you know, Japan does so well and they don't vaccinate, you know, they don't have vaccination requirements. A few years ago, Japan had an outbreak of rubella. I think they had something like, I'm just off the top of my head, so something like 15,000 cases. The United States actually issued a travel advisory for pregnant women who are not vaccinated to avoid going to Japan. So these diseases still exist out there in the world.
Even though the vaccination bill is, you just said for measles, it's actually for three different.
And that's what worries me about. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have a mumps outbreak,
right.
It's kind of a sentinel event. The MMR vaccine is what's used, so it's an indication that they could easily have a measles.
Is there a vaccine available? So would people be able to get their kids into daycares and schools if they just did? Is there just a measles vaccine?
Do not have separate vaccines.
Okay, there's only one vaccine that's for measles, and it always includes.
And there is a version that also includes chickenpox, varicella as well.
But yeah, basically, there, you can't get, in the US, I'm not aware that you can get separate measles, mumps, or rubella. And the name for measles is rubeola, because sometimes people get confused between rubella and rubeola. I better stop now, I can keep going.
It's called hard measles and...
German measles, yeah.
Well, the rubella is German measles, and we have hard measles.
And rubella is generally a mild, milder, except in pregnant women, it has, you know, congenital rubella, you know, it's...
Does rubella present the same way as measles? Do you get a rash?
Yeah, you get a rash. It's another febrile rash illness. Okay. Any other questions about this? So hopefully we'll be done with this.
There are no more questions.
Any other you want to talk about?
So before we get to the council member updates, I just wanted to let you know, in your packets, there's a resource list of suicide prevention resources in the state. There's reports of work group resources, and on the back there's some contacts. I'm going to include these. We'll be including these as part of your notes as well. But this is one of the things that we're starting to do so that we can hand these out at our meetings with regard to our topic that we're going to be focused on. So, and we'll be having some more folks that are going to come in and talk about some of these resources. Okay.
I'd like to give the council members an opportunity for any updates. Kate has an update, and anybody else that has any thing that they would like to share.
So our Rotary and Track Club are working with ending sex trafficking. So there's an educational event at YE Middle School on May 4th. So I'll pass. And so there's like specified speakers that are great experience in the field, and they're talking about how to prevent it and kind of the red flags and indicators about it. And so we went and talked to some officials about it, and it was very interesting to see it.
And this is which group?
It's with Rotary.
Rotary.
The Rotary Club of Greater Park County. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have a link to this too?
We have like a website on
the... Okay, we'll include that in the notes as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other updates? And I'm going to remind everybody that we have confirmed that we will be moving our meetings to every fourth Tuesday, I think, here. Mm-hmm. Or we like to just mention that. Makes it that people are really confused on where to go. So here on the fourth Tuesday of every month, and or we'll let you know if that changes.
It's
going
to change our time.
You have to have it. Yeah. It's all your fault.
Adrian will be back here, then we'll be all
correct.
Back here.
Correct. So, and again, you know, we'd like to thank you guys for spending the time with us. We really appreciate it. It's good to kind of have that face-to-face time. It is important work that you do, and we'd like to help with that in any way that we can. And we're looking forward to working with you and our community partners and, you know, getting the common goal of improving our public health in our community. So thank you for all of your work that you do with the county.
We certainly appreciate all that you do, too. Your time, your talent, and putting it together for the community. Thank you. Informative. Nice to see this.
We have lots of fun here.
And good food.
And usually good food, yeah.
Always food.
Always food. Yeah.
You're welcome whenever you'd like.
Yes. Jokes.
It's another Tuesday
night. Yeah, right. Listen, you've been having a lot of beautiful
diseases. Yeah, absolutely.
Love it. Deanna's rolling her eyes.
You guys get to hear it tomorrow morning. Yeah.
Awesome.
All right.
Sorry.
Yeah. If I could just say to the councilors, to Sean, the staff here does a great job. They take really good care of us. I've worked in government my whole professional career. I've always been very impressed with the team here. So you should be
good to know. And I will add on to that I've worked in
in Texas and in California and now here with health departments, and this is the best.
Yeah, they're here.
All right. We're adjourned.